Good evening, good morning, wherever you are. You're tuned in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. Welcome to the first of three Friday the 13th in 2015. That's right, you heard me. Three Friday the 13th this year. Quite an astonishing feat. We're going to be talking with our guest, Mitch Horowitz, about superstitions and the occult this evening on the show. We'll talk about the history and mystery behind Friday the 13th and other bizarre rituals and superstitions that have been a part of our culture for so many years. Where did they come from? Why are people superstitious? Are there new superstitions that are cropping up, or do we just stick with the ones that have always been there? We'll find out more about that from the expert on the show this evening. If you'd like, you can join me. Of live chat going on over at my site, darknessradio.com. That's darknessradio.com. It's free. It's fun. You can join in over there, and I'll be able to filter in some of your questions and information during the show. So if you have questions for our guest, I will try to intersperse them during the show this evening. We will also be opening up phone lines a little bit later on tonight. So if you have questions for our guest, you can be a part of that, and open phone lines for the last 2 hours of the show. There's a lot on the plate tonight. I hope you're here for me for the entire haul. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We've got more right here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Dave Schrader. I'll be your host this evening on Friday the 13th. My guest, Mitch Horowitz, was raised in a world of Bigfoot stories, UFO sightings, and Carlos Castaneda books. He grew up determined to find the truth behind it all. Mitch has written on everything from the war on witches to the secret life of Ronald Reagan. He is vice president and editor-in-chief at Tarcher Penguin, the division of Penguin Books dedicated to metaphysical literature. Mitch is also the host of Origins, a new web series on the history of superstitions. Tonight, superstitions and rituals on Coast to Coast AM. Mitch, thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. This is, now I'm right in this, right? This is a year where we have three Friday the 13th?
Yes, it's pretty wild. Usually we have no more than two, but this is a bumper crop for Friday the 13th.
Well, let's jump right in with this. The Friday the 13th, this is a bizarre date. Is there any real history showing that Friday the 13th has been historically more dangerous than any other day of the year?
You know, the most fascinating history behind Friday the 13th is that almost every culture in human history, separated by wide spaces of time and geography, has superstitions around the number 13, and specifically Friday the 13th. It was a number that was feared in ancient India. They believed you should never sit down to a banquet where there were 13 people at the table. In Nordic mythology, Loki, the god of evil and maleficence, was the 13th man at a banquet that ended in violence. And of course, Judas Iscariot in Christianity is considered the 13th apostle, or the 13th man at the Last Supper. So people have had negative associations with 13 going back to deep antiquity, and it got bound up with Friday probably on account of the tradition that Christ was crucified on Good Friday, which associated Friday as a day of maleficent luck when it was paired up with the number 13. So every culture seems to be united in this fear of the number 13, and specifically on Fridays.
Now, did this happen? Was the fear of 13 prior to the death of Jesus and associations with that in Christianity? Has 13, as far back as we can look into history, been something that people fear?
It really has. And what's remarkable is you can always pinpoint certain starting points for a given superstition. But when you have starting points all over the globe, so that if you were looking at a map of world history and you saw fear of the number 13 spread out across this map, both in time and geography, you start scratching your head and asking, why is this so widespread? The number just seems to show up again and again in human history. Another example is that the medieval Knights Templar were almost wiped out after a conflict with the Vatican on Friday the 13th in the year 1307. So we keep coming up with this date again and again in history.
Do you know, have you ever taken a look at the numerological side of this? Does 13 equate to any kind of power number or evil number or bad luck in numerology as well?
It almost exists outside of our Western conception of numerology, because we operate off a system of base 10 and we try to reduce the digit 10 to single numbers. So 13 almost stands as an odd man out in our Western numerological system.
So we can kind of look at the understanding of why 13 seems unlucky. I mean, there's been a lot of weirdness and actual connections with that. But as we look into current days, even through the 19th and 20th century, yeah. Has there been any kind of actual correlation with bad things happening on Friday the 13th? So as far back as I can remember, I don't really remember anything happening. We're all aware of it, and we're all looking for that shadow, that specter to fall on us. And I just don't remember through my life having anything bad really reported in the news, aside from what you'd hear on any other given day.
Yeah, it's hard to measure these things. I mean, human events are so vast that most of the time when people complain about Friday the 13th, it just comes down to individual stories and anecdotes. But the stories are frequent enough so that, for example, there are many hotels that will not have a 13th floor. There are airlines that will eliminate a 13th row. I was in a hotel recently in Virginia Beach, and I noticed, and it had been built sometime in the last 25 years, it was built without a 13th floor. So you'll find that anecdotally, people have so much fear of it that it actually gets incorporated into architecture, into buildings, and into air travel.
Mitch, isn't that kind of silly? I mean, it's not like there's not a 13th floor. We just named it 14. We went right from 12 to 14. Why not have a 13th floor just be an empty space, as though if you really buy into that, I mean, nobody's really fooled by the fact that the buttons in the elevator go from 12 to 14.
Right. We're tricking ourselves a little bit. And, of course, hotel management doesn't want somebody coming down to the front desk and saying, hey, you know, I don't want to stay on the 13th floor. Or I don't want to sit on the 13th row of the airplane. I mean, it's a little trick that we play on ourselves. At the same time, there's a part of me that believes that some of these tricks have something healthy behind them. There's something about superstition that keeps us humble. I don't think it's a kind of irrationality that drives us necessarily to do foolish things or to behave in unethical ways, but rather it keeps us mindful of the fact that there are machinations in the world that we don't fully understand. And I think it interjects a little dose of humility into our digital culture. I have to confess, there's a part of me that sort of likes superstition for that reason.
You know, I had a lot of the Coast listeners popping in with quick emails and mentions to me on the chat room and in my email telling me, what about Apollo 13? There's Apollo 13. But on the other side of that, that was a pretty good luck flight in the sense that they shouldn't have survived. They shouldn't have been able to come back from what they were dealing with. But on the upside, everything went okay.
Well, it is tantalizing and scary that Apollo 13 had that number attached to it. And you'll find things like that throughout history. But yes, that was a challenge that actually turned in to a great moment of human heroism and ingenuity. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, if given the choice, there are certain things that we'd want to avoid. You know, we don't want to be the person who gets thrown off of a donkey on the road to Damascus. But if that doesn't happen to you, you don't have the opportunity to come into some greater or higher realization. So bad luck is not necessarily something you want to run away from. Bad luck can be good medicine.
I know you do a lot of research and understanding of the occult. Does superstition play a role in the occult, or has maybe the occult bolstered the belief in superstitions?
Well, you know, in a certain sense, the word superstition goes back to Latin, and it was a way of deriding people who had irrational beliefs. But the truth is, a lot of what we call superstition or folklore attaches us to some of the most ancient traditions of our ancestors. Our ancient ancestors, wherever in the world we may be from, live their life according to seasons, according to symbol, according to imagery, and some superstition today really incorporates some of that into modern life. For example, in most cultures across the world, people believe that trees were sacred, that trees housed gods or good spirits. Now, conversely, some people also believe that trees housed demons or evil spirits. That's where our tradition today of knocking on wood comes from. We knock on a piece of wood so as to sort of shake out an evil spirit, like we might be shaking a bug off of a blanket. That's the kind of thing today that seems sort of small. To some people, it might even seem sort of silly. But the truth is, it is a thread that ties us to our ancient ancestors, who were much closer to the natural world than we are. They saw trees as sacred. Well, we knock on wood. It's thousands of years later, but we still have some thread of connection to them. And I kind of like that.
And knocking on wood, would draw out the demons. Why do people associate it with a sign of good luck? Or if you don't want something negative to happen, why do you knock on wood then now? I mean, how has it been kind of tainted and twisted through history?
Well, sometimes people will say they had a good year in their business, for example, and you'll see them knock on wood. They don't want wicked demons or wicked fairies to curse them. You know, people are very wary of talking about their own good luck, and maybe some little wicked wood spirit hears it and places some sort of a curse on you. You find this in ancient China. You find it in the European Middle Ages. It's been with us, and it's traveled all around the world.
So your best bet is, if you want to talk about what a great year you've had, just don't have any wood around you at all.
Well,
then they can't get irritable with you.
Only to knock it. The best bet is to be humble. You know, the best bet. And
sure.
In a certain respect, I think superstitions are really just a way of us ritualizing humility, something that we ought to be practicing all the time. What knock on wood really says is, don't be a braggart. Keep your voice low. If you've had good fortune, you don't have to go shouting about it.
With occult practices, is there anything more symbolic or powerful about the number 13? Does it create more energy or power for negative forces?
Well, some people do see 13 as a representative of negative forces. Look, there are some people I know who practice occult rituals, who are very dedicated to occult and esoteric ideas. They see 13 as a day of good luck. I've been invited to Friday the 13th parties being held by people who are interested in the occult, who feel that 13 is a mystical number, is a number filled with portent and magic and possibility. So I guess it all depends upon where you sit. Some people see it as sinister, but some people who are into the esoteric see it as potent and magical and powerful.
Well, I guess as long as you're not a promiscuous teen smoking marijuana or having premarital sex, you should be pretty safe on a Friday the 13th.
Well, it's funny. Another day, there's a time period that people get worried about, and that does seem to have more science behind it, and that's a period we just came out of Mercury retrograde. That's
right.
A period of time that also occurs about three times a year. Lasts about 3.5 weeks, where due to an optical illusion, the planet Mercury seems to be moving in retrograde motion, moving backwards from Earth. Now, I can tell you there are some odd statistics and a lot of personal stories in which people will attest to travel getting disrupted, things breaking down, terrible accidents happening during Mercury retrograde. That, in my mind, has actually proven to be a more potent and more widely shared number phobia, if we could put it that way, than the number 13 in our culture.
Do you find that there is any scientific backing to Mercury retrograde?
The science is tricky because, again, there are so many, we live in such a complex world, and there are so many things happening at any given time that it's difficult to pin down specific cause and effect. But I will tell you, there are air traffic controllers who have attested that they will chart more accidents or more near accidents during Mercury retrograde. There are IT specialists and computer programmers who publicly would swear to be the voice of rationality, but when you speak to them privately, they will acknowledge that they experience greater breakdowns and computer crises and snafus during Mercury retrograde. I encounter it all the time. It's difficult to study these things because the world is complex and there are a lot of different things going on at once. But I have found lots of people, supposedly very rational people, including surgeons, who were very wary during Mercury retrograde.
What about, you know, we've heard about the full moon and that the lunatics are on the prowl on full moons, that it has an effect on the tides, it has an effect on the water in our systems, which seems to drive us crazy. Again, that seems to come from a superstitious point, but do we have proof that there really is more insane activity taking place on a full moon?
At times, there have been studies that have shown a greater incidents in reported crimes in urban areas during full moon periods. And this has left sociologists and criminologists scratching their heads. It's led to speculation and theorizing that, yes, you know, maybe the cycles of the moon do have an effect or correlate with some kind of cycles within human nature, just as they do correlate with and affect the tides. So again, you know, there have been certain studies. They're not conducted frequently. They're uneven. Some of these things go back years to the 1950s. But there have been studies that suggest a greater instance of reported crime during periods of full moons.
You would think, just from a skeptical point of view, that crime level might be better or more active on a full moon night because criminals wouldn't need to use flashlights or exterior forms of lighting at night because there is more natural ambient lighting allowing them to kind of creep around and do the things that they would, you know, be seeking to do.
Well, maybe in antiquity or you know, at least a few generations ago that would have been true, although we live in a world today where the world seems to be illuminated all the time. A strange facet of contemporary life is that most of us really don't know true darkness anymore. Wherever you live, even if you live in a kind of a rural area, you really can't get away from artificial light, even if it's just the illumination of the clock on the bedstand next to your bed. All kinds of appliances increasingly have light bulbs that indicate whether they're turned on, whether they're turned off. We live in a world that's flooded with artificial light. We don't live as close to nature anymore, which might also suggest why our ancestors were more attached to superstition, signs, symbolism. They lived a lot closer to nature than we did, even in the Victorian era. And the cycles of the moon probably meant a lot more to them. They were easier for them to track. These things are obfuscated in our world today because we live amid so much technology, so much artificial light. Although, again, you know, the effects may still be felt on our bodies and our moods.
I want to know this. The blood moon, people have made so much about the blood moons, and I believe there's one or two more coming this year. Are there any that sync up with our Friday the 13th this year?
I don't think we have any blood moons coming on our Friday the 13th. The next Friday the 13th, it's not far from now. It's in the month of March. We're going to experience it about 2 weeks from now. I'm not aware of the blood moons specifically syncing up with that.
Is there any kind of indication? I mean, you know, there's been thoughts that this blood moon might be ushering in a new cycle of upheaval in the world and kind of as a sign of apocalyptic times. As you look at things that, you know, celestial bodies, the moon, the stars, Mercury retrograde, all of these possibilities that people have been focused on for so long, again, is there any kind of real empirical data that we can look at to say, you know what, every time there has been a blood moon, this happens? Or we do know that in history, when there's been a series of blood moons like this, it has truly ushered in a new time.
Well, this is my perspective on that. The world is so complex today that I think it's very difficult for people to predict macro events, you know, global scale events based on astrological phenomena or other natural phenomena. I do think that sometimes these things can have effects on our own individual moods and aptitudes and feelings of anxiety. But the world is very, very complex today. And back when astrological systems were first taking shape in ancient Babylon, ancient Egypt, ancient Chaldea, the truth is, life was much more simple. If you were born a farmer, chances are you were going to die a farmer. If you were born royalty, you were going to die royalty. People died young, and their stations in life didn't change very much. Today, life is much more dynamic and much more complex, and I don't think that global events are shaped by some of this natural phenomena, although I do think that it can still exercise an intimate pull on us as individuals.
Tonight we're talking about the science of superstitions. Why do we believe in the things we believe in? Is there any scientific data to back up these belief systems? Where do they come from? What are the origins of all of these strange superstitions? And are there new ones? We know about the famous ones. We'll also talk about the fact, are any new superstitions developing from weird things that have happened around the world in the last 100 years? We'll talk with our guest, Mitch Horowitz, about that this evening. If you've missed any part of tonight's show or any of the Coast to Coast AM shows and you wonder how you can find them, go become a Coast Insider right now. It's very plain, very simple. Go right to coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com. $0.15 a day gets you access to over 5 years of past episodes, gets you live chats with George Norrie and other hosts of Coast to Coast AM, and some of the best guests. You'll also get access to the great news stories and so much more. Go check it out at coasttocoastam.com. You'll also find links to George's TV show and so much more. Find out why we are the best in overnight talk radio. Coast to Coast AM, your home for the strange and unusual 7 nights a week. I'm Dave Schrader, your host. We've got more coming your way right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, go over and check out the Coast to Coast website. We have a feature story up, Origins of the 13 Superstitions. That's Mitch Horowitz's episode from his new web series, Origins, which explores the history of superstitions. Our hot story tonight on the website, Defeating the Devil, Why Exorcism in Australia is on the Rise. Peter Monroe meets some of the foremost demon wranglers and people who say they've had their souls saved. That's all right over at coasttocoastam.com. Go check that out and also become a Coast Insider. Again, 15 cents a day. You can't go wrong. Check that out. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tonight, we're looking at superstitions, rituals, and the occult with our guest, Mitch Horowitz, right here on Coast to Coast AM. It's Friday the 13th. Tonight we're exploring superstitions, rituals, the occult. Our guest is Mitch Horowitz. And Mitch, I've got an interesting email that popped in while we were at break time here from one of the listeners who mentions the number 13 has positive connotations in some cultures. Maya cultures revered it as the key number to time itself. Native Americans use the turtle shell, which has 13 sections to represent the 13 lunar cycles. And, of course, Andrew, the author of this email, says he personally considers it a lucky number because he was born on a Friday the 13th. So I guess there's some good that comes from this crazy date. Why do people, when you look at the number itself, I mean, are there any other numbers that people associate with evil besides a 666 or bad luck? Or is it just 13 that's really kind of sidled with that?
Well, 13 is most heavily sidled with it. Numerologically, people have associated numbers that are not divisible as possibly having some kind of bad luck, but 13 really has taken on a connotation in our lives that no other number has. There are numbers that we venerate. Some people feel that every structure of life is composed of three parts. That's an ancient esoteric teaching. The numbers 40 and the numbers 7 reappear again and again throughout Scripture. Some people venerate the number 33 in certain teachings. 33 is considered to be the age that Christ had reached at the time of the crucifixion, and the highest rank attainable within Freemasonry is, of course, a 33rd degree Mason. So there are other numbers that have a certain mystical or sacred quality about them, but only 13 is a number that seems to frighten people around the world, except for people like your very special listener who wrote in and made some very perceptive comments. So there are some people who do indeed view 13 as a sacred number, but not an evil one.
Well, you talk about scary and superstitious angles. In your research, what's the scariest superstition you've actually come across?
The scariest superstition I have come across is probably one that involves a figure that I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of called Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary is supposed to be this horrifying apparition that you can summon up yourself in your own home, and when she shows up, terrible things are going to happen. You might get your eyes scratched out. She might scream at you. You might get attacked. This is actually a very new superstition. Kids and adults began to talk about the presence of this apparition, Bloody Mary, starting in the early 1960s. The term Bloody Mary has, of course, been around for a long time. Some people associated that term with Queen Mary I of England, who was considered bloody because of acts of religious persecution. But the whole idea of there being this apparition, Bloody Mary, that you can summon up, is something that first really began to make the rounds in Europe and the United States in the early 1960s, not very long ago at all. And the superstition around it goes like this. It's very simple and it's very scary. You go into a pitch black room in your house, usually the bathroom. You close the door, you close all the lights so that it's so dark you can't even see your own hand in front of your eyes. You look in the mirror and you say three times, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, come to me tonight. And the superstition is that this horrific, murderous apparition will appear. I strongly suggest superstitious or not, that none of your listeners try this. But
why is that? Why would you suggest that?
Well, talk about tempting fate. I have sat in a room full of investment bankers, very materialistic, rationalistic people, and told that story to them and said, now, do you guys believe that this is real? And to a person, they all said, no, of course not. And I said, would you do it? And they all sort of looked at one another and started giggling and said, well, no, we wouldn't do it. You know, there's this little part of us, this little instinct, this little scent trail that we have for the fact that there just maybe, an invisible world. And I wouldn't tug too hard at that invisible world. But that superstition about Bloody Mary is the most terrifying one I have ever come across. Kids at sleepaway parties will, you know, dare one another to engage in it. There are all kinds of urban legends about people summoning up Bloody Mary and she runs screaming through the house. There have been all kinds of legends and superstitions about looking into a mirror and trying to tell your fortune or trying to see your future mate.
Right, scrying, sure.
Yeah, but this was a real terrifying twist on that, and it became popular in the early 1960s.
Well, that's one I can personally attest to, because every time I'm in Las Vegas and I start summoning up Bloody Marys, I lose all my money.
That's right.
So there's got to be something involved in that. There's also, have you heard the weird variation of that, Mary Worth?
Oh, yeah, that's another association. That's another people connect up Bloody Mary with a terrible child murderer who was infamous in London, I think, in 1963. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe that was the original story. So, yeah, there was this bizarre case, and people thought if you summoned Mary Worth, calling upon her three times, she would show up. A lot of times she would begin by, like, clawing the face, or you would be damaged by the glass of the mirror might shatter outward and do damage to you as well.
That may be the birth of the Bloody Mary superstition. It can be really tough to trace exactly what the starting point of some of these things are, but that might be the birth point of that superstition.
Well, and I know there's some weirder stuff. Ursula Bielski had written a book and talked about the Candyman curse, which is very similar to Bloody Mary and Mary Worth. And when you call upon Candyman and the mayor, he would make these appearances, which was based on a real guy, again, from England, Purple Achy. Was kind of this, what everybody thought was an imaginary character who would harm children. And it turned out that he existed. He was this extremely large black man that would, and still lives, I believe, out there. But he was abducting children and doing some damage. And it turned out that all of these people started to have these memories of this guy. They referred to as Purple Achy. And it's a great story. I don't know if people have found that, but I'd highly recommend looking up that legend, because that's one of these strange legends, Mitch, that actually turned out to be true.
Now, there's a legend here in America that's somewhat similar to that. It involves a scare around killer clowns, people being terrified that they were stalked and threatened by killer clowns. In Boston, in the early 1980s, residents started complaining to police that killer clowns were lurking around schoolyards and playgrounds and terrifying kids. And the police dismissed it as just a bunch of, you know, hysteria or imagination. The same reports began to emerge in Rhode Island around the same time in the early 1980s. And ever since, this has happened in Atlanta, it's happened in other cities, there have been spates of reports that pop up every now and again in American cities where people are calling the police department complaining about the presence of these terrifying, maleficent clowns. This happened recently in Newark, New Jersey. No one's ever gotten to the bottom of it. We don't know whether it's just mass hysteria or there's something behind it, but that's something that's been going on in America for the past 30 years or so.
Right, and I guess Stephen King's book, It, didn't help that
at
all, propagated that weirdness. Well, there was the story, I don't know if you saw this in the news a few weeks ago, Mitch, but where some kids were out, they were probably, I think, college students that were out doing a film project, and there was this really weird couple that suddenly appeared out of nowhere wearing these creepy white masks and just stared
that.
At them. Oh, it's a bizarre story. If I can find a link to that, I'll send it over to our website manager, and maybe they can put it up at Coast to Coast AM. But it was just a bizarre story. And these people, it is something straight out of a horror movie. But sure enough, they're this couple standing out in the woods in the background while these teenagers were filming, wearing these stark white kind of kabuki-looking masks. Very chilling. Yeah.
People are weird,
Mitch. Yeah, people are weird. Let's talk about the you know, we've talked about some of the chilling aspect of it. you touched on a little bit ago. I mean, are there practical sides to these superstitions? I know some of these sound like folklore, you know, where the folklore always was just basically a way to try to keep control of children. If you're bad, the boogeyman will come get you. This will happen. That, you know, there's always some lesson, kind of a parable to the story. What's the upside of superstitions?
You know, some superstitions have had a very practical side to them over the centuries. Many generations ago, we didn't realize that sneezes could spread communicable diseases. But as it happens, really going way back to antiquity, going to ancient Egypt, ancient Persia, ancient China, people believed that the breath was synonymous with the human soul, and that when you sneezed, the expulsion of breath could be the expulsion of your own soul. So people started covering their mouths and noses when they sneezed. Well, obviously, it was not until centuries later that we realized there was a real practical benefit to that, too, because, of course, now we understand that sneezes spread germs and communicable diseases. Another thing is the breaking of a mirror. You know, the breaking of a mirror is associated with 7 years of bad luck. It's something people are very frightened of. Well, until probably 150 years ago, mirrors were very expensive items. They were rare luxuries. They were owned by very rich people. They were owned by royalty. It may be that part of the reason that superstition arose was it was a way of scaring household servants into handling mirrors with great care. The same is true of the superstition of opening an umbrella in the house, which is supposed to bring you bad luck. Well, the first rain umbrellas were enormous, very high-tension umbrellas. They became popular in Victorian England, a place where there was plenty of rain. If you open these things inside of a crowded Victorian parlor, you're almost certain to break something. So this superstition may have grown out of a very practical interest in keeping people from committing an act of very real bad luck by opening an umbrella in a crowded parlor filled with baubles and vases and glass objects. So superstitions also have a practical side.
Right, but again, it almost seems like a parable in a sense. It was just a way to kind of convey a message, and, you know, nobody's just going to listen to, please don't open up your umbrella in here, it irritates me. So we've got to put some kind of dire consequences attached to it.
Right. Although it's interesting, if you go back many centuries, obviously people didn't have a way of knowing that a sneeze would spread something called germs, which our ancient ancestors had no understanding of. But nonetheless, covering your mouth was a very good idea. There's another tradition. It's practiced in many parts of America today. It's supposed to be bad luck to place a hat on a bed. There are places in this country, particularly down south, where if you place a hat on a bed, you're considered to have committed a major violation. Now, that superstition probably goes back to ancient India, where hats and other objects worn on the head could contain head lice. So if you put them on a bed, the lice could spread to the bed. And so the admonition against putting a hat on a bed was considered very practical. But if you fast forward to the 20th and 21st centuries, it's also considered a terrible act of bad luck. You know, so sometimes it's difficult to say which came first, the practical side or the superstitious side.
We're going to take phone calls after the top of the hour. If you have some questions, we'll intersperse them through the hour with our guest as we talk about superstitions. And we'll have open phone lines for the last 2 hours of the show. If you'd like to talk about your own superstitious beliefs and thoughts, I'd love for you to spend time with us this evening. If you have stories of the strange and supernatural you want to share or just want to chat, give us a call and be a part of the show this evening. Our guest right now, Mitch Horowitz. We're talking about superstitions. We're talking about rituals, just the bizarre nature of people in general. I mean, it is so weird that we adhere to these. I mean, you watch it happen every year with sports teams, right? They start winning, and you'll notice that the main player stops shaving, or
right,
they start wearing the same socks every day, day in and day out for these events. And it's something that they, you know, boxers will tape their hands the same way. They'll wear the same makeup under their eyes. You know, it just kind of depends on that. Sports seems to be one of the most focused locations for superstitions.
Absolutely. You know, an interesting superstition that you'll find among gamblers and sports folks is that they don't want to get out on the so-called wrong side of the bed. You know, sometimes we'll use the expression, he got up on the wrong side of the bed. Well, according to superstition, there really is a right and wrong side of the bed. People who are superstitious in these matters do not want to get out on the left side of the bed. The ancient Egyptians associated the left side of objects with death and destruction and despair. And that's where this notion came from that you can get up on the wrong side of the bed. So that is a practice that's popular among certain gamblers, for example. If they're in Vegas, they will be certain that they get out of bed on the right-hand side.
Didn't that have something to do, too, with the bed servants when the rich and wealthy, they used to use bedpans, and then they would discard them to the left side of the bed so that the maids, matrons, things like that would come in and collect it from that end. So if you rolled off onto the left side of the bed, you had a good chance of stepping into it before and starting your day poorly.
It's another example of how the practical and the arcane could get joined together in superstitions. That's a good enough reason for me not to get off on the left side of the bed.
All right, one day that everybody, well, not everybody, but most people deal with is a wedding day. Whether you're a guest at a wedding or you are involved in the wedding, there seems to be a lot of really bizarre rituals that go into wedding days. You can't see the bride in the dress before the wedding. You need to have something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. There's just all of these bizarre rituals. Where did those start to come into play?
I tell you, weddings are the most occult ceremonies around, and we all go to them, we all participate in them, and we have no idea we are engaging in a wide range of occult rituals. Now, you'll hear a lot of women complain about having to buy bridesmaids' dresses. They're expensive, you only get to wear them once, everybody considers it sort of a drag, but the fact is, the tradition of bridesmaids goes back to ancient Rome. The Romans believed that evil spirits would be lurking around the bride, so they created the tradition of bridesmaids to kind of create these decoy brides who would distract the evil spirits. Now, my personal favorite wedding tradition is an African-American tradition called jumping the broom. Jumping the broom means getting married. It's a slang term. But at some African-American weddings, the couple will quite literally jump over a broom. The reason for that is fascinating. In folklore that actually goes back both to Africa and the European Middle Ages, there's a belief that vampires and evil spirits are basically obsessive-compulsive, and that if you're being traced by an evil creature, you should throw some grain or pebbles on the ground. The evil creature will have to stop to count the objects before pursuing you. The same is true of a broom. If the couple jumps over a broom and one of them is an evil spirit disguised as a bride or groom, they won't be able to do it. They'll have to stop and count all the bristles in the broom. So it's supposed to protect you from marrying some sort of a demon that has replaced your beloved. Traditions like that run rife throughout weddings. There's almost not one aspect of the wedding ceremony that doesn't have some kind of occult roots or connotation behind it.
What about the something borrowed, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue? Do you know what's going on behind all of that?
That isn't one that plays out too much in American culture nowadays, but I can tell you that carrying the bride over the threshold is intended to help her avoid evil spirits and demons that might be lurking at the threshold. Throwing rice is a tradition that actually comes from Asia and India, where rice is considered a symbol of wealth and fertility. Again, you're throwing rice as a way of either placating or distracting evil spirits. Every step-by-step part of the wedding ceremony itself usually is tied in some way to thwarting the intentions of evil spirits who might take advantage of the happy couple.
How bizarre. Do you know anything about, I know some people take the wedding cake and will sleep on the wedding cake. What's going on with that?
But there's an old English custom that if a bridesmaid takes a piece of wedding cake and passes it through the wedding ring of the bride, she will get a vision of her future husband and soon be the next one to marry. So just every aspect of the wedding ceremony has some secret or mystical connotation to it. We forgot most of them, but we participate in them all the time.
All right, we've got Mitch Horowitz. He's going to be with us for the next hour as we continue to talk about superstitions and the occult and rituals. We've talked about weddings. What about funerals? Why do we wear black to funerals? And how does the Ouija board figure into superstitions? Those are just a few of the questions we'll tackle. Plus, we'll be taking your call right here on the best in overnight talk radio. You're tuned in to Coast to Coast AM.